Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm great, David. Thank you very much.
So this has been another crazy week in news with all kinds of dueling fake town hall debate things and other kinds of crazy statements by various politicians and an encroaching election. But we've decided to put all that aside for this week and do something fun as a palate cleanser, as a way of celebrating our subject without getting into the minutiae of today's politics. And it's an idea that was suggested by, I think it was by a listener, Frank. Is that right?
Yes, Mimi in Edinburgh suggested this.
I think she's one of our most dedicated listeners. So yes, thank you, Mimi in Edinburgh,
yes.
Wherever you are, for this idea.
It should be said that Mimi in Edinburgh has a close personal connection with one of us and is our most loyal listener, largely because she listens to make sure that I haven't been too mean to you or bullied you too much and occasionally says, you need to apologize to David. So anyway, so Mimi from Edinburgh, one of our most loyal listeners, has suggested today's topic.
So do you want us to say what Mimi suggested, Frank?
Yes. So Mimi suggested that we talk about sort of cultural representations of the period we study. So movies, books, musicals, what have you. She said, you know, it started with a kind of question, which is very interesting for my period of, you know, what's your favorite movie about it? And then, so she thought we should do an episode where we talk about this. And so we've identified several different categories and we're going to spend the next few minutes talking about the period before 1800, the 19th century, and then the 20th century. And the categories are?
Our TV shows. This is like Jeopardy, right? Yep. TV shows, film, musicals or plays, novels, and potpourri. So other kinds of popular culture things, whether that's popular songs or video games or toys or what have you.
Right. And can we clarify one thing? One thing that occurred to me, David.
We need to probably clarify several things, Frank.
Well, we probably do, but I would make a distinction. So when we talk about representations, these are essentially fictional representations of the past, of these periods. So therefore, the Grapes of Wrath wouldn't count because it's contemporaneous to the Depression.
Exactly.
Even though we might watch it as a historic artifact today.
Or The Jungle or these kinds of things. Right.
Right. So it has to be. So there are other examples of films from the 30s or 40s that look back at the 19th century that would count. Or to look at Mark Twain. Huck Twain is out. Sorry. Yeah. Huck Finn is out. But if you a Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court might be in, although it's not really in the period in one of the periods in question.
Huckleberry Finn is about the antebellum period, and he's writing in the postbellum. So there's some gray area in here. Our rule: there are no actual awards being given to anybody, so the criteria are entirely artificial.
This is a peak podcast, which is two middle-aged guys talking about minutiae and making up rules that they're then going to violate. I mean, this is about as podcasty as you get. But okay, I think we understand what we're doing.
Did you have any other criteria?
No, that was my biggest issue was, okay, these have to be representations of the past.
Okay.
Pass to the creators of those representations, if that makes sense.
And
does that make sense?
Yes, that made sense to me. That was one of my rules as well. The other rule had to be, it had to be something that I both consumed as a media product and enjoyed.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't expect you're a dark guy, so maybe you would consume something and hate it and then put it down as a favorite.
But there's some stuff you like read and you say, like, I'm supposed to read this because it's, you know, part of the cultural conversation, it's good for me.
I got you.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. But like I had to be something I enjoyed, and there's obviously a bunch of stuff that I think I probably should read at some point, but I haven't read yet, and so I'm going to sort of exclude stuff that I, you know, haven't consumed. In fact,
one of my 19th century novels raises some of these interesting issues, David. So I'm sorry. I shouldn't have been so disrespectful to you. I'm very sorry. I didn't mean to upset David.
Oh, I have a fairly thick skin. I'm okay. How important was accuracy also into you before we sort of get into our actual picks?
I think that may go into why you like something or possibly didn't. But all of these, I mean, what I did think long and hard about what historical fiction means while we were in preparing for this episode, and the whole question of accuracy is quite interesting. I think it's a factor. I don't think it's necessarily a determining factor. Okay. What about for you?
So the rule I established, which was a totally stupid rule, was that if it's something that's trying to be historically accurate, then it matters. But if it's something that isn't trying to be historically accurate, then it doesn't matter.
Right. So if accuracy was important to the filmmaker, that's appropriate to judge them by it.
Yes.
Right. I see what you mean. Okay.
Now, okay. So
this will be an issue perhaps with musicals.
Yes. Right. Okay. So the first category is TV shows set in the colonial era.
Or prior to
1800.
Go ahead.
Oh, so I've got an honorable mention and a winner. And my honorable mention is John Adams, the series on HBO.
Yep. Okay.
And my winner was Roots.
Interesting.
Now, Roots stretches into the post-1800 period, but most of it is during the colonial era. So I'm going to go with Roots as my winner.
Okay.
The 1977 version, there's the remake version, which is okay too. But for my money, the original is the one that I would give the win for that one.
Well, we did not consult each other because I had Roots as my honorable mention and John Adams as my winner, perhaps as befits a historian of the American Revolution. But and I struggled with this, actually. First of all, I would say there are actually very few choices because there's a terrible thing that's been on Sky here about Jamestown, which I haven't seen. But there are very few good TV programs set in American history broadly conceived prior to 1800. I think John Adams is really good. I think I really like Paul Giamatti as an actor. I thought Laura Linney was great. On the other hand, and I struggled with this, Roots was so important. I mean, to some extent, you're a bit younger than me, David, so you didn't see it the first time. You know, it was a big deal. And it was, now we're used to kind of what was then called a miniseries. Now we think of kind of long form drama, you know, something that is 10 parts or 7 parts, whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, that's become a kind of norm. And John Adams is a good example of that. Roots, at least in the American context, was the first of those. And it was a big budget thing. And of course, in the context of the 1970s, having a TV show like that, that focused almost exclusively on African Americans was really unusual, frankly. And when we get to some of the other TV programs we're going to mention, that you know the absence of non-whites will probably be pretty notable. So I think so I was tempted by Roots, and interestingly, the aforementioned Mimi said to me yesterday, I hope you're talking about Roots. And Roots, you know, as somebody growing up in Sweden at the same time that I was growing up in the United States, she said, you know, that was such a big deal in Sweden. Mm. So I think Roots, I could be persuaded to go your way on that. Anyway, I think Roots versus John Adams is a very interesting thing. How do you feel? I mean, I haven't actually looked at the original Roots in a long time. I mean, does it hold up?
So I rewatched it recently because they made a remake of it a couple of years ago, and I was being interviewed about the remake, so I decided to sort of watch both of them. And they're both very good. The remake is more brutal to watch than the original. I mean, the original has some brutal parts to watch in it for what was appropriate in 1970s era television. And the remake is you know, obviously has come out after 12 Years a Slave and other glory and other kinds of things that demonstrate the brutality of slavery in a very graphic way. You know, one of the things the original pulls its punches occasionally. They try to make some moderately sort of likable white characters or white characters who are debating the morality of what they're doing that you don't find in the remake. But yeah, I mean, I like LeVar Burton in it. You know, later to go on and star in Star Trek The Next Generation and Reading Rainbow and other things. I think Roots. I think it's just the importance of that is a cultural artifact of what it, you know, said to people in the 1970s, and obviously the book that preceded it by Alex Haley is also very important.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's more of a landmark than John Adams. I think John Adams is just, it's really well so, it's so well made, it's so well acted. It's much better than the book by David McCulloch that it's based on, which isn't terribly good. But the John Adams miniseries, to some extent, is the product of a process that started with Roots. It's sort of the combination of Roots plus other long form drama on HBO like The Sopranos and The Wire and everything else. I mean, but that Roots to some extent is the foundation for that. So,
all right. So now we get to the 19th century.
So we're going to
which way do you want to do it?
Oh God! See, this is not planned, people. I thought we were doing all the categories for each century, and then moving up, as opposed to
Okay. Which one would you like, Frank? It's your choice.
Well, I planned for the for looking at a particular era and then moving on, but I kind of like what you've suggested because it does then lead us to look at the history of a particular genre.
Okay, so let's do that. Okay, so do you have a television show for the 19th century?
Yes. I have a couple, and it came down for me to two shows that are quite similar, and I watched them both as a kid, although I wasn't kind of cognizant when they came out. The Big Valley versus Bonanza.
Ooh. Okay.
You know, and they're both kind of epic-y, soap opera-like westerns. Bonanza's, where's it set? Montana, Wyoming? I don't know. The map burns at the beginning where the Ponderosa is. But the Big Valley is set in Northern California around Sacramento in the kind of Central Valley. And both were really good. I mean, are you familiar with both of these?
I'm familiar with Bonanza.
Right. Well, I'm going to give it to the Big Valley, though, because the Big Valley actually has a better cast. Bonanza has this weird premise because there are these five adult men living together, and Ben Cartwright is the patriarch of he's their father, but they've all got different mothers. But the kind of
okay,
the kind of premise,
it's like
of Bonanza,
Brady Bunch, but really,
it's a blended family in the 19th century. Bonanza is very interesting. I think Bonanza is probably more important in the history of television, but the Big Valley has Barbara Stanwyck as the matriarch, so it's got a matriarch rather than a patriarch. It's got Lee Majors and young Linda Evans are half siblings, I think. I enjoyed The Big Valley more, and when Nick Barkley got rabies, that was a big deal in my house. I think of these two kind of they're similar in genre, but as kind of nighttime dramas set in the 19th century West. But I think I'm going to give it to The Big Valley, which was set. Now, I did think, and I don't know what, I don't want to preempt you. I struggled to come up with comedies, and I don't know whether you remember, and this is a show they would not make today and probably shouldn't and couldn't make today, but I did enjoy when I was a kid, and this might be horrible to admit. Did you ever see F Troop?
No.
So F Troop was a comedy set in the West. Now, the big problem of it is there's a lot of red face acting, and the portrayals of indigenous peoples is problematic. Although they're also sending up the kind of cavalry. It's about a cavalry company in the West. And it's a comedy a little bit like Hogan's Heroes was, which again is a comedy you wouldn't make today.
No, you would not
make a comedy about the Nazis today the way they made Hogan's Heroes. And F Troop was a little bit like Hogan's Heroes. And I realize I don't have any comedies here, but I'm going with The Big Valley.
I don't have any comedies either.
And I like comedies a lot.
I was also struck by how many of the shows that came up for the 19th century were all Western frontier shows. So like Little House on the Prairie.
Yep.
Deadwood, which is obviously a very different kind of show.
Yes. They are not often paired.
No. Well, but what I'm going to pick is part of the rule about the how realistic it is, because it's actually not about the 19th century, but it is about the 19th century, and that's Westworld.
Okay. Right.
It's about the romance of the West in the 19th century, in the Wild West. And I think there's lots of echoes with Buffalo Bill Cody and you know, the ways in which people want or don't want a realistic version of the past when they go into the, you know, when they imagine the past. And it's, I thought it was just a, you know, well acted and well produced show. And obviously it's based on the sort of movie from several decades ago with Yul Brynner, but the HBO series Westworld, I think, does some interesting things about sort of the legacy of Westerns and the legacy of the West. And it does interesting things with Native Americans, does interesting things with Civil War, the sort of legacy thereof. So yeah, that's my sort of unorthodox pick for the 19th yeah. century.
Interesting. Okay.
Good. One thing I was struck by thinking about the, you know, the 18th and 19th century is there aren't really as many as I thought there would be. Just, I think it, compared to how many there are on British television that are set during those same time periods.
Yes, I would agree. Well, there's very little on the 18th century. There's just full stop or earlier pre-1800. Yep, you know, I agree with that. And the 19th century, as you say, a lot of them are Westerns. I mean, Bonanza and the Big Valley, the two I cited are, and there was Rawhide and Wagon Train. There were a whole bunch in the 60s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. Of course, the Western was the dominant genre in Hollywood, so in films as well as TV for a big part of the mid-20th century. But you're right, there isn't, once you stop looking at Westerns, there's very little. Not much on the Civil War.
I mean, there's been a couple recently. There was one called Underground.
Right.
There was one called Mercy Street, both of which were, I thought, were very well done, but didn't really get the kind of mass audience that one would have hoped they would have gotten. And part of it, I think, was that because they were trying to be very historically accurate and they weren't necessarily all that much fun.
Yes, that's true.
You know, and I think part of what makes something a pop culture is it has both the historical, you know, setting and says something about the past, but also is something that people enjoy watching and are looking forward to the next episode.
Well, and Deadwood did that really. You know, Deadwood did that sort of, you know, it's The Wire in the Black Hills, right? In the 19th century, essentially. And Deadwood's really good.
All right. 20th century is a bit easier because there's a bunch of things that are set in the 20th century. What are your
my
picks?
Two. And again, I have an honorable mention and a winner, and it was difficult to get much between them. My honorable mention is Mad Men.
Okay.
And my winner is The Americans. And The Americans is the winner because, as somebody who remembers the 1980s, you know, it captures the zeitgeist of the 1980s perfectly. And it's got resonance, you know, Russian spies.
Spies, and sure.
The story's really good. And in part, the characters are more compelling. You know, the people in Mad Men are all awful people. Which does
mostly,
make it,
yes.
Mostly, yeah. Which, you know, and but, I mean, I enjoyed them both very much, but I'm going for The Americans over Mad Men.
Listeners, we did not compare notes beforehand. Those are my two picks as well. I had them flipped. Just because, I mean, I've enjoyed both of them tremendously. I thought Mad Men did more different things over this, you know, period of time than The Americans did. The Americans, there were points which it got slightly repetitive for me. But as somebody who was living in DC for the much of the period that film was, or that show was on or taking place during, I was sort of struck by how much that felt right.
The Americans. The
Americans, yeah.
Right, yeah, I agree. Right, but you had Mad Men first.
I had Mad Men first and The Americans, but I could have flipped them either. And, you know, there were a bunch of other ones I thought were decent, but those are the ones that jumped out at me. I mean, we didn't do, there's a bunch of other ones that we could have picked that are sort of, you know, comedies. We didn't do Happy Days. We didn't do MASH. You know, but those are ones that are, you know, they're set in a different time period. You know, they're both set in the 50s, and they're sort of both made during the 70s, which I think is interesting about sort of what points people have nostalgia for and sort of how that cycle works. But I don't think either of them had anything particular to say about the historical time period they were in, other than just sort of a place to set funny bits.
Right. Well, and MASH is, of course, about Vietnam, but it's set in Korea, so they could be about Vietnam. But I mean, I think of those two, because I thought of both of those. MASH has aged much better than Happy Days. Happy Days just isn't very funny, actually. It's okay.
Right.
Whereas MASH, you know, MASH is still pretty funny, and MASH has a kind of, it got sentimental at the end, but it, you know, those early seasons are really quite subversive. And there was a kind of, in thinking about a lot of these questions, 1970s American culture is really interesting in terms of filmmaking, music, everything else, and MASH is of a piece with that. Sorry, you guys are, you might be hearing a dog barking behind me. I'm dog sitting at the moment for my son's pup, so I apologize.
Well, we have a guest on the show, and that's important.
We do. Yeah, say hello to Bella, everybody.
Right. Okay. So that was our first category, TV shows. Films, I think, was a bit easier, partially because they're, you know, part of the difficulty with making a historical TV show is you need the budget to have all the costumes and the sets and the stuff. So films in the pre-1800 category. There aren't as many as I thought there would be.
No, there are not. I mean, there are if you move away from North America, of course. But
sure.
So my choice was actually a Canadian-Australian production, Black Robe.
Oh, okay.
Which I think is 1990 or 91. It's about a Jesuit missionary among the Huron in Canada. Have you seen this?
No, I haven't. I've heard of it.
It's a great movie, actually. And it's one of the few movies on the accuracy question. It's really good. It's centered on the indigenous people. Almost all of the actors in the film, apart from the Jesuit missionary, the Black Robe, are indigenous. Mm. It's really, really good. Really good. And it's a favorite of mine that I return to a lot. Although it's Bruce Beresford, the Australian, I think he's Australian director. It's a really, really good film. Really good film. It's probably my favorite pre-1800 film. There aren't a lot. They're just, you know, and there are a lot of bad ones in the middle of the 20th century, but that's my choice. What about you?
Now, well, why do you think that is? I mean, why don't we have a good revolution film?
I don't know. I mean,
you don't like The Patriot? That's not.
I do not love the Patriot. I mean, The Patriot teaches well because it's problematic in all kinds of ways. And that's one where they got lots of accuracy. So there were lots of reenactors who had the right kinds of guns and things like that.
Mm.
Last of the Mohicans is pretty good.
That was my top pick.
I would have that. It's better than the novel, which is terrible.
yes.
But I don't know the answer to that, David, because the revolution would seem ripe for this kind of treatment. You know, early on in the beginning, you know, when the film industry first started, and I'm talking that, you know, around the First World War, they didn't do it because they didn't want the British to be the villains.
Sure.
but that's so, not really the explanation now. I mean, I don't know. I honestly don't know the answer. There's the film revolution with Natasha Kinski and Al Pacino, but
yeah.
It's Al Pacino.
Well, and that one was not well received.
No.
If I recall correctly, I think Al Pacino like stopped acting for several years as a consequence afterwards because he wasn't happy with how people responded to that movie.
Now there's a bicentennial film. Sorry, go ahead. I was going to say there's a bicentennial film with Alan Alda about the bicentennial and making a film about the revolution. It might be called Miss Liberty. The name escapes me right now. And that's pretty good, but that's about the problems of making a film about this period, not a film about the period. Anyway, what's your honorable mention?
Well, it's my honorable mention, and I didn't know whether this belonged here or belonged in the theater category, was the movie of 1776.
Yeah, I think that's cheating, though. I think that has to go in the musical.
Okay, game. I'll save that for later, though, because but the movie version of that, I thought actually is really kind of fun and good to watch.
Yep, all right, I agree.
But yeah, okay, so we'll bump that back to the musical theater category. But yeah, I had Last of the Mohicans, which I had difficulty picking one, but I thought, you know, it gets lots of the details right. It is better than the novel. You know, it has a great soundtrack.
It's exciting. It's hard. You know, it's good stuff.
It's a movie that if somebody says, like, here, let's watch this, I don't say, oh, geez, I'm watching that again. Like, you know, it's a fun movie to watch, and it does interesting things with the story and the setting that are.
Yeah, I mean, Daniel Day-Lewis is such a good actor. He's rarely in a bad movie, and he's great in that film. That's a good film. That's a good film.
All right, 19th Century.
No shortage of films here.
Yes.
I kind of avoided the Civil War because I thought you might go in that direction. So I thought, oh, Glory or Lincoln, and those are both. I'm going in a different direction, though. We mentioned Westerns earlier. The Western was the genre of the middle 20th century that Hollywood produced the most of. And I'm going, therefore, in part because I think he needs to be represented somewhere here, which is the film director John Ford. So I'm going with My Darling Clementine by John Ford.
Ooh, okay.
Which is Henry Fonda playing Wyatt Earp, and it's a really good movie, really good film. And it's one of Ford's better, you know, Ford famously, when called before the House Un-American Activities Committee, when asked to identify, didn't name names, but said, you know, I'm John Ford, I make Westerns. And John Ford actually has a good sense of humor, and this is often forgotten. And there are some funny bits in that film, and sending up the kind of machismo. Anyway, My Darling Clementine with Henry Fonda. What about you?
My pick here is sort of obvious for people. It's Glory, which I think is still an extraordinary movie. I show it to students all the time. There's some problems with Glory, both historical problems and interpretive problems. But you know, in terms of a film that was both important to me it came out when I was, I don't know, 12 or something. So it actually had sort of an impact on my life choices. It still makes me tear up in certain places. So I think the fact that the movie that I've seen probably 1,000 times still has an emotional effect on me means it's doing something right. My honorable mention is probably as a much smaller budget film made by a filmmaker in Kansas. It's called CSA. Have you ever seen this?
I have not.
No, okay. So this is sort of a low budget film. So the quality of the sets and the reenactments and stuff are not great. The premise of it is it's a British documentary company making a documentary about the Confederate States of America, but in this alternate reality in which the Confederate States win. And so it's about the future of the Confederacy after 1865. You know, and so the Confederacy lands on the moon, and the Confederacy, you know, gets involved in international politics and talks about the continuing problem of enslaved people running away, but what that looks like for something that's happening in the modern world.
When was it made?
I want to say it was made 15 years ago. So it's a fairly recent film, relatively speaking. But it does, they have interesting sort of ads that are supposed to be from the modern Confederacy for insurance, and so you can insure your enslaved people, which they describe as property, you know, and so it's like property, you know, it's an interesting film, and it does interesting things with the history and makes you sort of think about, you know, what the Confederacy was all about.
David, there's sort of a theme in some of your choices, because Westworld is about these. You're picking things that are interpretations of the period rather than films direct or TV programs or directly about the period. I mean, it's simply an observation.
Well, I'm attracted. You know, when I think about, you know, reading both historical fiction and watching films, I often don't gravitate towards the things that are trying to be accurate depictions of things, because if I want an accurate depiction of something, I go and read a history book. You know, what I do in trying to sort of be entertained and be surprised and be someone who's being creative, I sort of gravitate towards seeing people who are doing something a bit weird with it. And Bella agrees.
Yes, she does. She does.
All right. 20th century. Again, obviously, we've got tons to pick from here in 20th century land.
I have two honorable mentions and a winner, I think. The two honorable mentions are favorite films. So I'll try to be quick because I realize we're going on a bit. Mate One, do you know the film Mate One, John Sayles' film from 1989 about strike in West Virginia in the late 20s or early 20s. I think that's a great film. And it's got one of my favorite actors, character actors, David Strathairn, who's actually playing a kind of leading role there, in her, which he doesn't do very often. I think Mate One's a great film. I also really like Miller's Crossing by the Coen brothers.
Yeah.
Set in the early 1930s. It's a gangster thing, but I was thinking, well, the Coen brothers are so great. So I like both of those films. But I think the best film, my favorite film, in portraying a large span of 20th century history, is Godfather II.
I'm not surprised that that's your pick. Okay.
No, okay.
It's a very good film.
Yeah, definitely. Yes. Yeah. I'm sort of on an island with a billion people on this one.
Yes, okay.
It's an obscure little art house film you might not have heard of, David, called Godfather.
Exactly. Okay.
But that's the one with all the flashbacks, you know, it begins in the early 20th century and so on and takes it. Yeah. So, yeah. And I think that's, as a portrayal of the 20th century, a particular slice of 20th century history, that's my choice. What about you?
Okay, so I've got four films, they're for different reasons. So I really like Spike Lee's Malcolm X.
Yep.
I thought that was, you know, both a well-made film. It's a very watchable film, but obviously something that's dealing with a very important historical topic and does it well. And I think there's interesting resonances when that film came out and what Spike Lee was trying to say at that particular moment. But I also wanted to have films that were not just I wanted to have a comedy in here, and I wanted to have something that things that were sort of fun and weird and were sort of playing around with the historical time period. So the other ones are less serious. Good Morning Vietnam.
Yep.
With Robin Williams, which is, you know, it's has a serious edge to it, but is fundamentally a comedy, I guess. Raiders of the Lost Ark, which I'm picking simply because that's a film that I watched that we had when we had a VCR, we only had one video movie and that was it. And I watched that probably a billion times as a kid and, you know, punching Nazis is good. And Back to the Future, which again is probably more nostalgia for me than anything else because it is playing around with sort of the differences culturally between the 80s, you know, in the 1950s.
And they go to 2020, don't they, in that film?
Well, they go to like, then the second one, they go to like, it's like 2012 or something.
Right.
So it's already passed, and we have not gotten the hoverboards or the lace-up shoes. The Cafe 80s, I think I have seen those. So there's some bits they got right, but not much. Right. Okay. So those are our choices for films. And again, obviously these are our personal choices. They are eclectic and mean nothing.
Anybody who's still listening to this knows that.
Okay. Right. Category three, musicals or plays?
Pre-1800.
Yes.
There really are only three choices, it seems to me, and I would include all of them.
Okay.
Hamilton, 1776, and The Crucible.
Yeah, those are the three I had as well.
That's it. I mean, well, that's okay. It. I mean, yeah, you know, The Tempest could be about the New World, but, you know, it's okay. I would struggle to choose between them. I probably like Hamilton. I really do like 1776, but
as do I.
I probably have Hamilton and The Crucible on kind of as co-winners and honorable mention to 1776.
Yeah, I mean 1770. The other two, Crucible and Hamilton, I think are more substantive and about the moments that they were created as much as they were about the historical time period. Whereas the musical 1776, what's that's trying to say about the, I guess that came out in the 1970s?
Yeah, it's written in the late 60s, comes out in early 70s.
You know, I'm not quite sure what it's trying to say about the late 60s and early 70s.
Well, there's a slight anti-imperial subtext there, which could be read as a critique of Vietnam, but you got to look for it.
Yeah, but that 1776 is a lot of fun. So if you've not seen 1776, you know, go and watch it. It's silly. Some of the songs are kind of dumb, but But there is some substance to it, and it gets.
Well, I think it's getting a revival both because of Hamilton and because we're coming up to 2026. Okay. You know, it was very much of the bicentennial, and we're coming up to the 250th. So I think people are going to get another chance to see 1776.
Oh, good. And The Crucible is obviously a great play by Arthur Miller.
I mean, it arguably, I mean, I wonder if a century from now. You know, high school kids might still be reading The Crucible. Maybe Hamilton doesn't age as well as we think it will. Because, you know, it hasn't aged. You know, seeing it on Disney Plus this summer, I remember thinking, oh, it's very much of its time. This is very much an artifact of the Obama years, and it doesn't sit as well today.
That's
only 4 years on.
That's true. Yeah. But the songs are catchy. So
it's great. It's great. Don't get me wrong. But
yeah. I have been in both productions of The Crucible in 1776.
Do you remember who you played?
Well, in the Crucible, I was the lighting designer, so I was nobody. In 1776, I was Bartlett from New Hampshire.
Wow.
And so I think my line was, New Hampshire says yay. I think I said that two or three times.
Inspiration undoubtedly for Jed Bartlett, the fictional president in The West Wing.
Yes, and I still remember the songs, although I won't share that with our listeners because I want them to keep listening. Right, 19th century.
What are you? 19th. So we're talking. I'm going to go in another direction here. Well, it depends on what you think of Oklahoma and when Oklahoma is set, because it's at the turn of the 20th century. Googled it, and it's set in 1906.
Because
I would have had Oklahoma, but it doesn't really fit. So I might reserve that for the 20th century.
The long 19th century.
But it is the long 19th century, because it really is about the West. It's a musical Western. But as a consequence, I'm going in another direction. I'm going with Aaron Copland's Lincoln Portrait as a piece of music.
Oh, okay.
Which... I'm stretching the kind of genre here, but I think that's really good. And the recording of it I would recommend is actually the one where Henry Fonda reads Lincoln's words. Cause I don't know that you're familiar with this, but it's a piece of music, but it's got spoken word in it. It's got Lincoln's words in it. And the version where Henry Fonda is speaking as Lincoln, and he played young Mr. Lincoln in a film, and is very good. So that's my 19th century.
Okay. I've got, Assassins by Stephen Sondheim.
Right, I don't know that.
Okay, so it's about people who commit assassinations. So there's a bit of, you know, with John Wilkes Booth. There's a bit with Charles Chateau. It came out, I want to say, like 20 years ago.
Right.
But it's about presidential assassinations from the perspective of the assassins.
Right. Is it any good?
It is quite good.
Yeah. Right. Okay. I
mean, if you like Stephen Sondheim, it's right. You know, it's catchy and playful and
yeah. Is it funny? I mean, this is material that's a little bit tricky to play with.
Yeah, I think it is funny. Yes, it's both serious, but it's not sort of laugh out loud funny. It's more of smirk funny, which I think is sort of in keeping with his style.
Right.
I had Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson as a follow up, which was a musical from about 10 years ago, which it's sort of trying to do the same kind of thing that Hamilton did, but instead of having rap music, it's like Green Day.
Right. Okay.
About Andrew Jackson. But the music isn't quite as good, obviously, as a Sondheim musical. So I went with Sondheim. And 20th century.
Well, I'll go with Oklahoma then.
Okay.
What about you?
I'm going to go with Frost Nixon, which began as a play before being made into a film.
I almost picked Nixon in China by John, the opera by John Adams.
Oh, that's a good choice. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think we need some kind of classic Broadway musical. So I'll stick with Oklahoma.
Okay. Oklahoma is a good choice, even if there are, you know, interpretive problems about that one, but
sure.
Yeah. All right. Novels. Okay. Now there's a lot to pick with novels, because obviously, you know, novelists can set things anytime they want to, without worrying about budgets. What's your pre-1800 pick for novels?
Right. I have to give an honorable mention to something that's not set in America because it's so good, which is for people who liked Wolf Hall and Hilary Mantel's trilogy, Cromwell trilogy, her earlier book, A Place of Greater Safety, about the French Revolution, is absolutely fabulous. But it's the 18th century, but it's not our period, so our area. However, so I really struggled with this. And I'll try to be brief, but I'll run through my finalists. There's a short story by Nathaniel Hawthorne called My Kinsman Major Molyneux.
Which I'm not sure I've read that one.
Okay. Well, it's worth reading because it's about a riot in Boston in the 18th century. And I think he's writing in the context of the riots in Boston in the 1840s and 50s about runaway slaves and so on. But it's about what it's like to be the victim of a riot. And so it's from the perspective of his kinsman, Major Molyneux, who's the narrator's kinsman, is a presumably a loyalist who's being tarred and feathered. It's not long, but it's really, really good. It's very powerful. Teaches well. But that was on my short list. Barbara Chase Ribot's novel, Sally Hemings, from the late 1970s.
Oh, sure. Okay. Yeah.
Was on my list. My two finalists, and I couldn't choose between them because both were really important to me in terms of my life choices, I think, are Esther Forbes's young adult novel, Johnny Tremaine.
Okay. Yeah. That was on my list too.
Read a lot as a kid and I think influenced my choices to become a historian of the 18th century, and Gore Vidal's Burr.
Okay.
And they were both really important to me in my formative years. One when I was younger, one when I was slightly, you know, I read Burr, I think, I don't know, when I was like 12, and it was sort of an adult book, and it was.
That's a huge book.
Yeah. And it's a very subversive view of the revolution. It's a Gore Vidal, it's a Vidalian view. So it's, you know, it's very cynical. It's funny. So I, from that list, I whittled it down to co-winners of Johnny Tremaine, which is more wholesome fare, and Gore Vidal's Burr. What about you?
Okay, so I also had Johnny Tremaine, which again is something I read as a child. I'm not sure I've read it since then, and I'm not quite sure what I'd think of it if I read it now. But you know, I thought that sort of captured a particular place and time, or at least I remember it doing that. And the other book is I picked another thing by Hawthorne, the Scarlet Letter.
Yep. Great book.
You know, and that's something I read in high school, and I didn't love it in high school, but I read it again maybe 10 years ago, you know, and thinking that I think if the more I understood about the context in which Hawthorne is writing it and the, you know, and the disjuncture between that and the period it's set in, I think it's still worth reading. Even if it's something people are forced to read in high school, I think doing it as optional reading is fun too.
Hawthorne has a very good historic sensibility, actually. I mean, he's very aware of his New England past and trying to come to grips with that. And, you know, he's descended from one of the judges in the Salem witch trials and things like that. I don't think Hawthorne gets enough credit. I think he gets a little overwhelmed in the canon by Melville.
Yeah.
But I kind of enjoy Hawthorne more, I think.
Oh, I do. No, I do too. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he was more popular at the time than Melville
was.
Yeah,
that's true. That's true.
Right, 19th century.
This I really struggled with. And this is one, where I came up with the, did you enjoy it or not? So one of the things that made my list was Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian, which is a truly great novel, but it's hard going. So I read that, finished, and I thought, okay, I am never going to read this again, you know? And so it didn't make it. I really enjoyed Sebastian Barry's Days Without End recently. But the thing I've really come down to is, I think, which I just love it as a book, it's a great book, is Lonesome Dove by Larry McMurtry.
Okay. Yeah. That's a very good choice. Yeah, no, that's
have you
okay.
read it? I mean, it's a doorstop of a book. The characters are well drawn. McMurtry is very good at writing female characters. Speaking of which, I gave serious thought to Isabel Allende's Daughters of Fortune, which is about a woman from Chile who goes to the San Francisco during the California Gold Rush, which then led me to think of Patrick DeWitt's The Brothers Sisters, or Sisters Brothers, sorry. It's two brothers whose surname is Sisters. DeWitt's a Canadian novelist, and that's also about the California Gold Rush. But anyway, I Lonesome Dove is something I've read several times and really enjoy.
Okay.
What about you?
I had a whole bunch of ones that I couldn't pick, so I'm just going to list them and people can, you know, they're all slightly different. Toni Morrison's Beloved is, but also the hard reading. Things that are, more fun, Killer Angels by Michael Shera, which is about the Battle of Gettysburg. It does, it evokes that place in a very profound way. Geraldine Brooks's March, which is the story of Little Women from the perspective of their absent father.
Ah, interesting.
But probably if I had to pick one that was sort of a fun read, that also evokes a time and a place, Caleb Carr's The Alienist.
Right. Yep. I thought about that too.
You know, because there's a grittiness to that that I really sort of appreciated, and a sort of a specificity to the geography.
Did you see the TV series?
I saw a couple episodes of the TV series. I didn't really get into it, but I think it was mostly because I had other obligations rather than it wasn't good.
Right.
Did you?
Yeah, same again. I really enjoyed the book and thought, oh, I'd like to get back and watch this, but just
haven't done it yet.
There's just too much.
20th century.
Yes. Now, my honorable mention goes to To Kill a Mockingbird, Harper Lee, which everybody read in high school, but actually is a very, very good book. But the book I really like, and as you know, I read a lot of mysteries and detective stuff. Walter Mosley's Devil in a Blue Dress.
Oh, that's a good choice.
And I think that whole series of E.Z. Rollins novels are great, and they really take you in through Black Los Angeles, right from right after the Second World War down to the beginning of the 1970s. But the first one, Devil in the Blue Dress, is really, really great. And so, and I think as a as an evocation of a particular time and place, it's fabulous. Yeah.
Okay.
What about you?
Oh, I had a hard time with this one because there's so many good choices.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought about Ragtime, which was a great, great novel, but I haven't read that in years. The one I ended up picking was 11/22/63 by Stephen King.
Right. Okay. You know, I haven't read that.
It's like most Stephen King novels. It's monstrously huge, so it's about the Kennedy assassination, but it's also about time travel. Sorry if I spoiled the novel for people. It does, again, tries very much, has the sort of sense of place and time that I found compelling. You know, this is the setting and the characters were great. And that was my pick. And obviously there's tons of things one could put there, but I thought trying to do something with the history, that was the one I chose.
I thought a lot, and this is a little bit like that in terms of time period, of the work of James Ellroy.
Oh, yeah.
And he's written, of course, the L.A. Quartet, you know, which is L.A. Confidential and things like that, which are very, very good, as well as a kind of series of they're almost counter histories of the Kennedy assassination and everything around that. But he's so dark. He's so dark. It's hard to enjoy. His mother was murdered. And, you know, so if you read the Black Dahlia, his novel, it's kind of about the murder of his mother. I mean, it's not, it's about a particular notorious murder in it, but it's hard to go. He's hard going sometimes, although he's a brilliant writer, but yeah. Good.
Okay. Now we get to the potpourri category. So other kinds of cultural products, whether that's songs, video games, comic books, paintings, toys, who knows what else. And listeners won't be surprised to know that I picked some video games because I like video games, but Frank, you're not so much a video game guy. So tell me about the cultural product that does the pre 1800 period
David, about video games, Tetris is going to be huge. I'm telling you.
Tetris, you know, there's things you can say about Tetris.
Anyway, pre 1800, if we're allowed to use paintings,
yes,
I would use,
paintings are great. They're
Jonathan Trumbull's paintings at the Capitol.
Those are good.
Crucial moments from the Revolution.
Yes,
so we've got surrender at Saratoga, surrender at Yorktown. What else is there? Bunker Hill's not there. No, the Declaration of Independence and Washington resigning his commission.
Yes.
These are big historical paintings. They're actually good paintings.
Yeah, they are good paintings.
I think, you know, like Leutze's Washington Crossing the Delaware isn't a very good painting, whereas Trumbull's paintings are good. So those are, that's my ephemera from pre-1800. I mean, or yes, he's right. He painted those in the 18, well, over a long period of time, but they're early 19th century representations of the Revolution, which he lived through. So he knows wherever he paints.
Okay. So my pick is Assassin's Creed 3, which is a video game that came out, I guess, about a decade ago, in which you get to play as several different characters, including a Native American character, and it's set primarily in Boston and sort of the greater New England environs. And so you get to interact with important leaders from the Revolution. You get to meet Benjamin Franklin, you get to meet George Washington, it does some interesting things with the history. It's one of these games where, if you know nothing about the American Revolution, you can play it, and it's a fun game. But if you know things about the American Revolution, there are things you pick up on, there's little bits and pieces, there are Easter eggs, and something that you might actually learn something along the way without trying to. So that's it's a game. So there's obviously places where they take huge liberties, but they things they try to get accurate, they do a good job with.
Right. Good.
And there's some interesting themes about who the, what sort of questions related to who's the revolution for, who wins the revolution, who loses the revolution. 19th century.
19th century, I have a song.
You have a song, okay.
I do. Well, I'm not going to sing the song, but it's...
Oh, it's too bad. Okay. neither of us are gifted singers, at least I'm not.
It's a song about the Civil War. Now, the Civil War has inspired a lot of songs. I mean, there were songs during the Civil War, but a lot of songs since the Civil War, many of which are kind of landmarks in the popular culture. I'm thinking of The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down and things like this. But they're also either... deliberately, or in some cases, either inadvertently, or in some cases, deliberately neo-Confederate in their approach, and I think those are problematic. One that is not is by Steve Earle, kind of country/ rock musician, and it's called Dixieland. I don't know whether you're familiar with this. So Earl recorded an album, God, it must be about 20 years ago now, with the Del McCoury Band. It was a kind of bluegrass inflected album called The Mountain, and this song is on that, and it's actually about an Irish immigrant who fights for the Union. And actually fights in the 20th Maine with Chamberlain, and it's a very good song, but it's also, I like it because it's a Civil War song that's actually about the Union rather than romanticizing the Confederacy. He's got another song called Ben McCulloch, which is actually about the Confederacy, but again, doesn't romanticize the Confederacy, but I'm going to, Steve Earle's song, Dixieland.
Okay.
Give it a listen, David. You'll like it.
I will. This show is going to be lots of things to read and watch and listen to. So that's great. So I had two honorable mentions. One is the band's The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down, which I think is a great song. And it's by a Canadian band, but it does have these sort of weird...
they're not all Canadian. Levon Helm is from Arkansas.
Oh, that's a good point. But
the band is Canadian. Yeah.
Yes. But exactly what the message of the song is and what it's trying to say about the Confederacy, it's a bit unclear. But it's a good song, so I picked that one as an honorable mention. The other honorable mention was Oregon Trail, which I think people who are of a certain generation, everybody played it growing up as a video game. Wholesome.
I played with blocks growing up, David. There were no video games.
I'm surprised you had blocks, Frank. I thought you just had to play with sticks or kind of.
I had a stick with a string on.
Exactly. But I'm going to pick a song, and it's a song by They Might Be Giants called James K. Polk.
Okay. All right.
Are you familiar with this band or the song?
I am familiar with They Might Be Giants. I am not familiar with this particular song.
So go listen to the song. It is very detailed About, yeah, they wanted to write a song about a president they didn't know anything about, so they picked Polk at random. Polk's actually a very important president, but he's not very well known. And so, but if you listen to the details of the song, they get like 98% of it right. And so it's actually quite good. And it's very hummable and whatnot. So, and it features a singing saw as the instrument that has a solo in the middle of it, which is, you know, a rock song that has a singing saw as a major theme and talks about James K. Polk in great detail. Highly recommended. Okay. 20th century. There's a lot, again, you could pick here. I have some guesses about what you might be thinking, but what's your pick for 20th century?
I struggled because there was so much. And so I tried to think of, just as I kind of went with directors I wanted to include, similarly, I was thinking, okay, well, so I have two finalists set in the same period doing the same, writing about similar things. And I don't think you will have guessed these. So one is the Warren Zevon song, Veracruz.
Okay.
Which is on the same album as Lawyers, Guns, and Money and Werewolves of London from 1976, I think, or 7. And that's about the American invasion of Mexico in 1916. And then the kind of as a companion to that would be Tom Russell, who's a singer-songwriter I really, really like, who should be better known than he is, who has a song about Pancho Villa's invasion of the United States at the same time.
Okay.
Called Tonight We Ride, and that's actually quite funny too. And so these are I don't think you would have guessed those.
No, those are not ones I would have guessed. I'm surprised.
But honorable mention, and this is one where it gets problematic about when things were created, because you could get almost anything from, you know, Woody Guthrie wrote a lot of historical songs. And I really like his song Pretty Boy Floyd, which of course is contemporaneous to Guthrie, so I don't think it counts. So I would go with maybe Joan Baez's recording of Pretty Boy Floyd as an honorable mention. Although Bob Dylan did a very good version of it in the early 1980s as well on the Vision Shared album. But anyway.
So. Okay.
What do you have? So what did you think I was going to have?
I thought you'd have something by Dylan in there. Because he also has some sort of historically themed kinds of things. But so my pick for 20th century is a video game called L.A. Noir.
Right.
Which I think you would actually enjoy. And I know you're not.
Well, I like noir as a kind of.
So if you can imagine L.A. Confidential, but as a video game, it came out about 10 years ago, I think. The acting in it is amazing. But it's set in Los Angeles in the immediate post-war, World War II period. So you can sort of see Los Angeles grow during the game. You really get a sense of place. You get to drive around and sort of visit Hollywood landmarks during the sort of a particular golden age of Hollywood. And it sort of does interesting things with both the history of that. It deals with the Black Dahlia murder. It deals with a bunch of police corruption, other kinds of things. So L.A. Noir is a great game for immersing you in a particular moment in time. And it's good fun too.
Right. Good.
Wow, so we have got some good things for people to try out here, and obviously our choices are somewhat eclectic and all over the board. But I thought we did a good job. But I think it's telling about which moments were hard for us to pick because there were too many things to choose from, and which ones were hard because there were too few things. Where there is untapped markets potentially.
Yeah, I mean, I would say pre-1800 is tough, or the choices are rather obvious, which is not surprising. We settled on a lot of the same things.
Yeah.
20th century is so rich that I would come up with a different list tomorrow, probably.
I would too.
And 19th century is in the middle.
But I think it is interesting comparing, especially thinking about the 18th century, how much British stuff there is from the 18th century, or things that are set in France in the 18th century, period dramas of various kinds. And there just really isn't the same affinity for that for things that said in the colonies.
And this really is a mystery because, you know, the revolution, I say this is a historical revolution, of course, you know, it's the foundational event. It's the moment of creation. The bookstores are full of books, you know, big biographies of major figures from the period and lesser known figures. And Hamilton, the success of Hamilton suggests there's an appetite for it. But there's relatively little in the realm of popular culture, even novels, set in that period, and this, and definitely films and television, and that mystifies me. I guess it just seems too remote to people. I don't know because, well, as you say, the British and French do it.
There is the television show Turn, which is set during the Revolution, which I haven't seen, but some people say is very good.
Yeah, in fact, I had Turn on my list. I think John Adams is better than Turn, yeah. And so I thought John Adams was the clear choice there. Turn's not bad. I mean, you have to accept that that's one where, okay, we're not going for, I mean, it's based notionally on the Culper spy ring, but, you know, you're suspending belief a little bit. Turn's not bad, actually. I enjoy. I haven't seen the whole thing yet, but Turn's okay. But again, you can count on one hand almost the kind of TV, good TV programs or films, sure, about the Revolution. There just aren't that many.
Yeah. Do you gravitate towards story set things, or do you run away from them?
I usually have
If somebody has a Thomas Jefferson movie next week, would you run to the theater, assuming theaters were open and it wasn't in the middle of the pandemic, or would you say, I'll wait until it's out on Netflix?
I do gravitate because there's so little. But you know, I mean, I that's a better question to direct to you about the Civil War, because with Last Drops, you often mention things like about your period. I'm less inclined when I'm looking for entertainment to gravitate to my period for entertainment. But what about you?
I'm actually the same way. I often try to, you know, when I, especially for reading fiction, I tend to gravitate towards things that are different than what I do, you know, my other waking hours, and same with movies. I'm happy to watch Civil War movies, but there's so many of them, and I have a hard time enjoying them as films sometimes, because right, I'm thinking about sort of what does this film say about this particular period and how it's different from other. I can't turn that part of my brain off as much when watching them and simply enjoy it as much as I can something that's completely divorced from things I study.
I mean, my favorite works of historical fiction, you know, 1 through 4, are probably the 3 Hilary Mantel novels on Cromwell, and then her book on the French Revolution. But they, you know, obviously didn't fit our criteria for this. And again, I can't recommend A Place of Greater Safety, the French Revolution book, with any higher praise. People who were put off, I don't know whether you read Wolf Hall and the other ones, but some people were put off by the kind of narrative voice of it, because it's all in the present tense. And A Place of Greater Safety is more conventional. I'm using that with air quotes in its approach. So, and it's absolutely fabulous. I think it's a great book.
Great. Well, I think we've given our listeners lots of things to consume if they want to distract themselves from the contemporaneous reality of elections 24 hours a day.
Or if we all get locked down again.
Exactly. Or if we all, when, if, yes, exactly, yeah. Right. I don't think we need to do Last Drops, Frank, because I think endorsed all the things we've.
This was a night at the pub with us. Nobody wants a Last Drop with us. They all want to go home.
All right. On that note, cheers.
All right. Cheers, David.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod, and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.